Okay, our next speaker is Gary Eisenstadt. He's a partner at Fregeri in Davenport in Dallas, representing clients in a wide range of labor and employment disputes and commercial litigation matters, in addition to mediation practice. He's board certified by the Texas Board of Legal Specialization in labor and employment law, and is a fellow in the College of Labor and Employment Lawyers. Gary's also the co-author of the SMU Dedman Law School annual survey article on Texas civil procedure, which he has co-written since 1997. He's been named to the best lawyers in Dallas in labor and employment law, listed in the best lawyers in America, and included in Texas Super Lawyers since 2003. He's also an amateur glassblower, which I find fascinating. We've been talking about it for the last few minutes. Gary's going to speak to us today about the potential problems involved when employees use their own devices, such as smartphones, tablets, and computers, to work on company business. Gary?
Thank you. So I thought before I started that you might like to hear from who I suspect right now is the most well-known bring-your-own-device person in the country, if not broader. And this person has brought a lot of experience to this subject from personal events and personal decisions that have been made in connection with the use of a personal device, and explains in some detail some of the issues that are surrounding all of this. Right, and gives you, she actually talks about four different topics. In the interest of time, we'll have her talk about two of them.
First, when I got to work as Secretary of State, I opted for convenience to use my personal email account, which was allowed by the State Department, because I thought it would be easier to carry just one device for my work and for my personal emails instead of two. Looking back, it would have been better if I simply used a second email account and carried a second phone, but at the time, this didn't seem like an issue. Third, after I left office, the State Department asked former secretaries of state for our assistance in providing copies of work-related emails from our personal accounts. I responded right away and provided all my emails that could possibly be work-related, which totaled roughly 55,000 printed pages, even though I knew that the State Department already had the vast majority of them. At the end, I chose not to keep my private personal emails, emails about planning Chelsea's wedding or my mother's funeral arrangements, condolence notes to friends, as well as yoga routines, family vacations, the other things you typically find in inboxes. No one wants their personal emails made public, and I think most people understand that and respect that privacy.
So, not a political statement at all on my part, but I thought what she had to say was fascinating, because she hits on three or four really interesting and key topics, right? First thing she says is convenience. Right. In hindsight, it would have been better, who knew, right, if I'd have used two devices, but I didn't because I wanted it to be more convenient. I think we can all understand that. Second thing she talks about is privacy, right? My yoga routine, Chelsea's wedding, nobody wants to have their personal email box. Again, a very ripe topic for this particular, very ripe subject of this particular topic. She also says access, right? Everything that I had that was relevant, you had it somewhere else, kind of what I call no harm, no foul. And the last thing that I loved was her interesting choice of words. I chose not to keep personal emails, which I heard as I chose to destroy and delete personal emails. You don't get those. Okay? So it's kind of an interesting thing, because what Hillary Clinton talks about, I think, is really not unique to her. I think that this whole area of the use of the personal device in the company workspace covers all of these areas and more. And so I'm gonna scoot ahead a little bit. Sorry about that. That's a little loud. And get rid of my survey and just go straight to what I think the issues are. So my topic's a little bit like Ryan's, right? There is no BYO device law. It's not like, as he said, patent law. It touches on a lot of different areas of the law. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to skip around and talk about various areas. And let me give you a little bit of a roadmap so you can know where we're going next. I want to talk about what I think are what I'll call security issues, issues about preserving data, getting a hold of data, customer issues. Then I'm going to talk about a little bit about data preservation. And then I'm going to talk about litigation because I think the BYOD and litigation cross-section is huge. Then I'll move over to the labor and employment side, finish up with some wage and hours, and then I'll give you my recommendations of things I think you should consider. But I'm kind of like Ryan in that I'm going to be all over the board. There is no one area. It's a lot of areas, and all I can do is give you things to think about. So let me give you a quick personal story. So as Pat was saying, I'm learning how to blow glass. So about 3 weeks ago, I'm going to my glass blowing session, and the guy who works with me is standing out on the street corner, and he's very angry. And I said, "What happened?" And he said, "Well, I came out for a little bit of fresh air." And this nice couple drove up in a Mercedes. And the woman in the passenger seat came to me and said, "We are in a bit of a bind. Would you be able to give us your cell phone so we could make an emergency phone call?" He saw it there for a second, reached into his hand, pulled out, loaned her, put his iPhone in her hand, and off they drove. Right? Horrible. No good deed goes unpunished. But you could see that really happening, right? If you're the CEO of a company, aren't you in a no-win situation? Somebody asks you for the cell phone and you say no, then you're a boor. And if somebody asks you for your cell phone and you give them to them, you're an idiot, right? There's no winning there. So, you know, a lost or stolen device, I don't think that that's a big secret or surprise to anybody in this room that we could see that happening. And so if you're going to allow people to use their own device, you've got to account for the fact that devices are going to be lost or stolen. So we'll keep that in our minds, right? The second thing I think is even less nefarious, and that is, hey, it's my device, and my kid says, "Dad, can I borrow your iPad or can I see your cell phone?" Right? And they do. And they want to look at your cell phone and they do it. And who knows what they're using it for when you're not paying attention. Nothing illegal, nefarious about it. But all of a sudden, they go to a site that they shouldn't go to. And I read a statistic two nights ago on CNN Money. And it said that companies like Verizon and Symantec, you know, the software virus company, they're reporting 1 million malware attacks, 1 million new malware attacks every day. Okay? So it doesn't really take a genius to figure out that getting that, having that happen to you would not be a really good thing, right? Nobody wants to be the person who's brought this virus into the workplace, but of course, on a BYOD session, that could very easily happen. So, you know, other things that we're going to see happen, again, desire to carry one device. But this next area to me, I think, is one of the most problematic, and that is, what do you do with the terminated employee? I'm right now in the middle of a piece of litigation where a client called me and said, "I have a non-compete with this guy. He's quitting, and I know he's going to go into business in direct competition with me in violation of his non-compete." So, of course, the guy used his own cell phone for personal business. He used his own laptop for personal business. We had to go and we had to trap all of that, right? We had to see it, we had to get it, but it gets very complicated because he's using his own device. He uses his own iPhone. What's his own iPhone backed up to? An iCloud account. So if I get his iPhone and I say, "You have all of this stuff that's on my phone, that, or on your phone that belongs to my client, you have to take it off." What does he say? "Okay, I'll take it off." 30 seconds later, he backs it up to an iCloud account. Boom, it's right back on there. Now what do I do? You say, "Well, I'd like to delete your iCloud account." He says, "Not so fast, my friend, because my iCloud account has personal pictures, contact information, texts, emails that don't belong to you. If you delete the iCloud account, they're all gone." The judge says, "That seems like a problem to me, and I'm not going to let you go that far." So we're now having to figure out all of this issue. This is a small company. They don't have the big financial resources that some of the larger companies do. This is a huge issue when you're dealing with terminated employees. How do you know for sure that they don't have information? How can you tell where they've accessed, what they've accessed, right? It's a huge issue, right? What about the issue of remote wiping? Because you may have obligations that say, "Oh my God, if your device is lost or stolen, we've got to immediately wipe it." Okay, and they may be saying, "No, you're not going to wipe it because it's my device." And you've got this huge tension here between your rights and your obligations and their personal rights. And I'm telling you, I think that this is a very sticky area, very sticky situation. What are you going to do about external drives and cloud accounts? Okay, well, I already talked to you about the iCloud account. Here's the other thing we found in this case. The guy had opened up a Dropbox account. Are you guys familiar with those? Right, a cloud account. You can go and post on it. Anybody who has access to it can get up to it, look into it, poke around at it. That's what General Petraeus did, right? They did drafts in Dropbox or Evernote or whatever it was. Okay, so we didn't know he had that until we got a forensic examination. And then we didn't, how do you tell what he's been into and out of from there? So I think these are very real issues and very real problems. And we've seen some in the case law, and I'll go through just some examples that reflect it. Okay, so one of the first cases that that's been out there that I want to bring to your attention is this one. Okay, Mr. Klayman versus Hillary Rodham Clinton. What's the subject of this complaint? Any guesses? Right. Her use of the personal device and non-turning over of emails, et cetera, et cetera. All right, so we've got that one. Let me talk to you about a couple of other cases that just talk about some of the federal statutes that might apply to this area. Okay, Garcia versus City of Laredo. Interesting Fifth Circuit case because of the way it comes about. I don't know that I think that the holding is so magical, but it's interesting the way it comes about. Employee has a phone at work. Wife of another employee goes to the place of business, to the city, and looks at that phone and sees some things on that phone that says, my words, holy cow, right? That's bad. Goes and turns it, shows it to the city, says to the city, hey, on this employee's phone, there's some bad stuff. The city goes to that employee's phone and looks at it and says, holy cow, there's some bad stuff on your phone. They terminate Garcia. Garcia sues and says, hey, you violated the Stored Communications Act. And if you actually get into the Stored Communications Act, it prohibits unauthorized access to a facility. So the debate was, what's a facility, right? And the Fifth Circuit said, well, a phone is not a facility. A facility is a facility like internet service provider, a server place, it's server hosting. So you lose on the Stored Communications Act. Another recent case that just came out, Southern District of Houston, last year, federal court, three claims. Now, let me talk to you about the facts of this case, because again, they're also very interesting. This case involves a situation where the employer says to the employee, come work for me. I know you're well known in the industry, I know you got a lot of contacts, and I know you know a lot of people. But you got to bring your own cell phone. Guy says, no problem, I'll bring my own iPhone, and he does. They work together for a while. The employee says, I'm going to give you 2 weeks' notice. Employer says, thank you, not necessary. You're terminated now. Remotely wipes the employee's phone. Employee sues. Said, you didn't have the authorization to remotely wipe my phone. Nobody said you can do that. Sues under three causes of action, three types of claims. Right? Stored Communications Act. Court says, Garcia, you lose. And then he sues under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. And if you're not familiar with that, it's basically a criminal statute. And the criminal statute says you are not allowed to unauthorizedly access somebody else's device or you can't exceed the authority that you're given, okay? And the guy says, you've exceeded the authority you've given me. And by the way, on the civil enforcement provision of this particular statute, it has a civil enforcement provision. It says you can bring a private right of action if you can prove a loss, keyword, of $5,000 or more. So this guy submits an affidavit. The affidavit says, I had all of this financial information, all these company information, contacts, et cetera, and he values it at $50,000. Ha ha, I'm golden. Court says, well, that's interesting. You got the $50,000, but it's the wrong kind of loss. The loss is the loss of the damage, all right, that was caused to you by the loss of this data. So what the court says, like if you had to hire a forensic guy to come in and restore and achieve it, and that's a $5,000 loss, that would be actionable. But that wasn't the kind of loss that you gave us, so therefore you lose. Okay, seems simple. Does that end the story? Not in my mind. In my mind, what that does is now that gives the roadmap, right, to the next guy who says, if I'm going to go down here, what has my affidavit got to look like, right? I've got to prove up a loss in this area, not this area, and I think this is coming back. I don't think it's going anywhere. Right? All we know is that that first lawyer who tried to get an affidavit of saying $50,000 picked the wrong category of damages. But I don't think anybody thinks it would be hard to get $5,000 of damages that would be actionable. Third takeaway from this case, the court declined to exercise subject matter jurisdiction because it dismissed both of the federal claims, saying we're a federal court, we're only going to talk about federal claims, dismiss the state law claims, right, Texas Theft Liability Act, conversion, privacy, et cetera, without prejudice. So I don't think that that's over. I don't think that's over by any stretch. A third case, which isn't an opinion, it's just a case that was filed about 3 weeks ago out of the district court in New Jersey. Really interesting case because it shows this juxtaposition between tablets, iCloud accounts, et cetera, et cetera. So let me walk you through it just because it's so interesting. Company supplies iPads to its employees, okay? So it's not a BYOD, it's a company-sponsored device. But the company then says, hey, just link your personal iTunes account to this iPad and your credit card. Okay, so far so good, the employee does. So put that on hold for a second. At night, at home, not on company business, not on company time, not on a company equipment, Nascimento texts another employee, okay, about a third guy who works at the company and says some mean, nasty things about third guy, okay? He's entitled to do that. Nothing wrong, illegal there. So then what happens? Well, then what happens is the company takes the iPad that it used to give to Nascimento and he gives it to third guy, right? The guy who's the subject of these bad texts. Well, because that iPad is still linked to his iTunes account, Nascimento's iTunes account, the guy sees all of these bad texts about him and he runs into the company and says, hey, look at all of these bad things they wrote about me. Anheuser-Busch says, yeah, that's not right. Mr. Nascimento, you're fired. Mr. Nascimento says, I didn't do it on company equipment. I didn't do it on company time. I did it on my own phone. You can't fire me for that. Company says, well, yeah, we can, and he sues for invasion of privacy and discrimination. Now, do I really think that this case will go anywhere? Ultimately, I'll be skeptical if it does, but I think it highlights an issue, right? You now have personal iTunes accounts on company devices, company accounts on personal devices, and the more intertwined these get, and they are, okay, the harder it's going to be for us to sort things out. I think that's exactly what we're going to see, and I think we're going to see more of it. So let me switch gears with you a little bit, because I only have a half hour. I can't delve into all of these subjects, but when you're using your own device, you've got to look out and know and understand what are your obligations, whether they're contractual, whether they're statutory, right? Do you have obligations under the Fair Credit Reporting Act? What about under HIPAA for medical, okay? I was talking with a friend of mine who's a general counsel of a company that owns a lot of nursing homes, and I said, what do you do about this? He said, I'm scared to death of it. I'm scared to death of it because I know in the nursing homes I got two nurses on the floor at opposite ends, and they're texting each other about the care of a particular patient on their own devices. Have I violated HIPAA? What about my record-keeping obligations? Holy cow! Right? So there he is again. I think, again, that's a huge issue, and it's not an easy one to be able to rectify because it's hard to know and see what's going on, and it's hard to control it. What if you have a breach? Don't you have to notify your customers? So as you're thinking through this, right, should we allow this or what should we do about it? I think these are things that you have to keep in mind. Are there other applicable laws? Let me give you another example. In Texas, it's not a big deal to ask somebody to use their own device. In California, it is. Okay? In California, if you ask somebody to use their own device, California law says, oh, they don't have to do that for free. You have to pay them and you have to compensate them for it. So if you're going to do this and you're doing business out in California, you better know what's going on. Let me switch gears with you and now talk about litigation. It's kind of my area, and I see this a lot, okay? So let's start with basics, all right? Everybody knows that documents are a big part of litigation. No secret there, all right? And everybody knows that documents these days include electronic data. Again, no big secret there. And everybody knows that the documents you have to produce are those within your possession, custody, and control, right? Again, no big secret there. But what do you do in the case of if it's a personal device, do you have to produce the text? Do you have to produce the emails? Well, do you have possession, custody, and control over somebody's personal device that they're using for work purposes? I think that's a real interesting question, and I think that the courts are kind of all over the board on that right now. I don't think that's been fleshed out at this point in time. But if you don't produce it, what are you likely facing? You're likely facing sanctions. What kind of sanctions? Well, spoliation instructions, okay? If you're not familiar with spoliation basically says that a jury gets to hear the following instruction, words to this effect. You, jury, may assume that the deleted or disposed of evidence is adverse to the party who deleted it or destroyed it and supports the party who wanted it. That's the spoliation instruction. That's pretty powerful, right? It's an inference that they get to make when they're making their decisions, all right? So that's one, obviously dismissal of claims, the death penalty sanction, and monetary sanctions as well. So what I thought I would do is just share with you a few kind of spectrum of cases that I found that have talked about this very issue. First one's from the plaintiff's side. The plaintiff, I love this case. The plaintiff is suing his employer, okay? Suing his employer for wrongful termination, et cetera, et cetera. And he knows he's going to do that. He has two computers. Well, he makes sure that the first one's not coming into evidence, and he does that with the use of a sledgehammer. Nice. Okay? Court says, okay, I'll give you the benefit of the doubt. Don't do that again. Now, you got this other computer. I want you to turn it over. Employee says, okay, no problem. Plaintiff says, I'll turn it over. He runs two different software programs on the hard drive to make sure that it is completely deleted and can never be forensically discovered, recovered. Right? Court says, you're done. You are done. You knew you had a duty to preserve this and you didn't. Case dismissed. Flip side, on the defendant's side, the In Re Produxa products litigation, okay? And I'm going to give you about a quarter inch of about a 10-foot story, and that is the defendant got sanctioned almost $1 million. And it's a long, tortured history, but bottom line was there was a lot of data, a lot of text messages that were should have been preserved that weren't preserved. How'd you like to be the person in charge of that case and have to report to your board or to your other officers? We've just been hit with a $1 million sanction because we didn't preserve evidence. I think that's very dangerous, and I don't think that's unique. Third case that I thought was really interesting was a case out of Puerto Rico, actually, in 2012. And this case is interesting because the officers used their personal email account for company business, and everybody knew that they did, okay? And that wasn't any particularly big secret to anybody that was out there. But they didn't preserve all of those emails, and the plaintiff moved for sanction. The court said, you know what, we're not going to for three reasons. One, there's no bad faith here, right? We don't find that they did anything maliciously to try to destroy anything. They weren't trying to cover up anything. They weren't trying to hide anything. The second thing they say, and I think this is particularly important for this room, is the inside counsel had a litigation hold letter on file right away. So they were clearly trying to do the right thing to preserve the evidence, okay? And the third thing is kind of what I'll call the Hillary Clinton excuse. Most of the information that they wanted, they were able to retrieve from other sources, because if you have an email that you send, even if you send it from a private account, somebody else got it. So you got the sent and receive, and they were able to recover it. Court said, I'm not going to award sanctions. Very, very briefly, I just want to bring to your attention a Texas Supreme Court from last year on spoliation and what they're going to do. Court says basically this in a nutshell, right? The way spoliation is going to work is that the court is first going to have to decide, not the jury, the court, did a spoliation occur? If it did, was there a duty to preserve the data or not? If there was a duty and it was breached, was it intentional or was it negligent? And then basically the court says, let the punishment fit the crime, and concludes by saying you only should get a spoliation instruction if you determine that the spoliation was intentional, right? Act with specific intent of concealing, and that a lesser severe sanction would be insufficient to reduce the prejudice caused by the spoliation. Let's talk for just a second about labor and employment issues. I want to talk about employment law. Obviously, there's nothing specific about BYOD and employment law, okay? But here's what I think you do find. I do think that the personal device is a very, very fertile ground for finding relevant evidence in these types of cases. I don't think there's any question about it. We had a case about 3 years ago. It was actually a non-compete case where this employee went from company A to company B, had his own personal iPhone. Somehow, his iPhone was linked to the company A's account, and he left, and company A was able to capture all of his text messages. Included in his text message was, this guy was married, was a picture of himself sent to another woman, not his wife, not clothed, and shall we say, focused on one very specific part of his body that was rather, well, you get the idea, okay? Not good. So that type of evidence is out there. The other thing I would warn you about is if you have work rules that relate to this area, make sure you're applying them consistently. Because that's how we get into trouble, right? We don't consistently apply our rules. On the labor side, you've got your Section 7, right, of the NLRA. And basically the question that you want to be looking at is if you have a BYOD policy, could that be determined a work rule and be the subject of mandatory collective bargaining under a collective bargaining agreement? So you want to watch out for that. The other thing I just want to tell you is, March, this just came out from the Office of General Counsel, from the NLRB. I'm positive you'll hear about this on Friday, so I won't talk about it in any great detail today. But the NLRB has given its guidance on what it thinks are appropriate work rules, and if you're able to figure out the logic in it, you're a lot brighter than I am, okay? Which wouldn't be saying much, but I would caution you to look at that in connection with any company handbook or policy that you have. So let me switch gears with you, and let's talk about the Fair Labor Standards Act, wages and hours. I have to go quickly through this. I just saw this the other day. It says wage and hour litigation is on the increase, particularly with layoffs coming down here in Houston. That's going to be more so. It's about an 8.8% increase. And how does this play out? Well, we know that employees have to be paid for time worked over 40 hours in a given work week. So what does worked mean, right? What's compensable time? U.S. Supreme Court basically said compensable time has to be the intrinsic part of what you do. This was a case where the employee said, you're searching our bags after work for security purposes, you should pay us for it. Supreme Court said, no, that's not really compensable because it's not an integral part of what you're doing. Now you're sitting there thinking, well, this is interesting, Gary. What does this have to do with the FLSA and BYOD? I think it goes right to the issue of compensable activity. I'll bet you there's not a person in this room who hasn't sent a text or an email to a secretary, an administrative assistant, you know, some non-exempt employee after hours asking them to do something, and then they get it, and they respond, and there you go. It's off-the-clock work. Is it being compensable? Is it compensable activity? It could be. Okay, if you do it once and please remind me to do X and they go, okay, is that compensable? Probably no. But if it's all of a sudden it's an hour's worth of work after hours, guess what? We got a clear roadmap as of exactly what you asked them to do, when you asked them to do it, how you asked them to do it, what they did, and how long it took. So I just want you to know I think that that's a big issue. I don't have enough time to delve into it, but I think it's huge. The case, this Long versus Alcoria case, says basically just that. Employer moved for summary judgment. Employees were doing emails and phone calls and whatnot, you know, after hours and on breaks, and they sued saying we should have been compensated for that. Employer said it's de minimis, it's not enough to worry about. Court said no, summary judgment denied. We'll let the jury decide. So I think that that's out there. I thought this cartoon was kind of cute. It talks about basically everybody wants to use their personal device at work. You know, it's part of the me enterprise, and he says, yeah, but what if something goes wrong? Well, he goes, well, then it's part of the you enterprise. And the guy says, I'm going to be sick. And he said, I'm sure you'll receive get well wishes from multiple platforms. Okay? So let me give you, just in the few remaining minutes I have, some recommendations that I have for you to consider. Again, we can't draft a policy here. But the first question you got to ask is, should you even have a BYOD policy? Is it a good idea to begin with? There are a lot of advantages. Efficiency, lack of capital expenditure, people can be work more efficiently, but there's a big trade-off, right? And if so, should everybody have it? You can make an argument that your lowest level employees shouldn't be allowed or required to do it, and that your most senior executives shouldn't do it either, right? It's just too dangerous. I know that there are people in this room with two phones and two iPads and possibly two laptops just for that very reason, and I think it's dangerous that somebody at the highest level either loses something or leaves. The second thing you want to look at is, do you have a technology solution, right? Is there? And one of the things that they talk about is, you know, this virtualization, okay? People can go to the cloud, they can look at it, they can work on it up there, but they can't ever download it to their own device. Then there's what's called the walled garden approach, which is, yeah, you can put it on your own device, but it's segregated, so if we remotely wipe it, we only get part of it. Remotely wipe together, say that three times fast, it's hard. And then they have limited segregation, okay? To me, that's just do the best you can to separate work and personal. I think it's a little dicey. Agreements with employees, I think those are critical, and I think these are some of the things that you should consider. I think you ought to address this issue of right to privacy and head on. Everybody feels like what's on my own phone, you shouldn't be able to get a hold of. But if you're going to use it for work, I think you've got to raise this issue and try to thread the needle and make the expectation clear that you're losing some of your privacy rights if you use the device for purposes of work. I think you also have to talk about remote wiping rights, and I think you have to address those. And I think you need to talk about external hard drives and cloud accounts so that you know what those are and what everybody's rights and expectations are. I like to have a list of all devices that people have so you know the universe of what you're looking at. Look, I recognize people lose devices, upgrade, change, whatever, all the time and may not think to tell you, but ideally you'd like to know that. I think it's also critical that people be required to report lost and stolen devices and that devices be password protected and that be mandatory. And here's, I think, one of my biggest takeaways for you guys. I'm not a tech guru by any stretch, but I think you've got to become tech savvy enough to know what these issues are. And I think you've got to understand what's happening, how it's growing, how it's changing. Look at the new apps. You've got Snapchat and Cyberdust. You know, those are the disappearing apps that, you know, where a message stays on for 15, 20 seconds and then it leaves. Cloud accounts, you've got to know what those are, where people have them. I think that's critical for you to do. Periodic IT examinations, I also think, is a great idea so you can see what people are doing. I think you've got to closely monitor external drives, you know, like the little thumb drives, and know and understand those. Also have a good idea of the source of your data, okay? What your documents are, what do you have document-wise, emails, texts, photos, voicemails, etc. So when you're doing a document retention policy, you know what it is that you're doing, okay? And what it is that you're trying to account for, you don't say, oh my God, I forgot all about that. On the litigation side, do those litigation hold letters. I can't think of a good reason not to. Make sure you've done it. Make sure you've done it timely. Make sure it's adequate. And make sure it's gone to all the right people who might have relevant evidence. I think that that gives you a little bit of a prophylactic help in the course of litigation. I think it's important for you to establish appropriate work rules and consistently apply them on the employment side and on the labor side. Again, just make sure that it's not violating a work rule so that you're triggering a collective bargaining agreement. On the FLSA, you've got to look for a technology solution of shutting people access off of emails after hours, or you've got to give clear instructions not to do it, or you've got to make sure they're paid. I don't know of any other way around it. And finally, I think you've got to know what your obligations are, contractual and statutory, in terms of retention, reporting, and destruction of documents, Fair Credit Reporting Act, HIPAA, et cetera. And I think you've got to make sure that you're covering all of those bases because you've got these wide-ranging, divergent interests between your obligation to the company under the statute and to your employees individually. Now, I guess what you could do is you could just say, you know what, I hear you, Gary, but I'm not really going to worry about it. I mean, after all, what could possibly go wrong? I think I'm out of time, and if you have any questions, I'll stick around and I'll be here at the reception, and thank you very much.